Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Welcome to GoTo Unscripted. We're here at the wonderful Amsterdam and as part of the GoTo conference. And I'm here joined by the lovely Flavia. Welcome to GoTo Unscripted. How are you today?
My pleasure, Julian. I'm fine.
Excellent.
Welcome to Amsterdam.
Thank you very much. Yeah, you're the local. I'm not the local. So,
yes. So
tell us, you're doing a talk today, which is part product and part tech. What's your history and how you've become this excellent person to talk about product and the human part of tech?
So I have a tech background. I think I studied computer science, and for the better part of 10 years of my first career, I wrote a lot of code, and which was Java, of course, then.
You don't have to apologize, Java's good.
Java is great. So, but whenever I wrote code, I always wanted to find out for whom am I writing this code? Who does it help? Who does it add value? And I think this kind of thinking brought me very close to design and design thinking and why are we doing this? So my career shifted from writing code to knowing why we are doing something like that. And I think I stumbled across this role called the product owner, which combines these two and actually things it makes about building products. And I think that's where I get energy from. So making a product, knowing for whom you make it, what value does it bring? And of course, combining my study tech to build a product. And it's so amazing to be in tech all these years, how much it has changed, how much you can do with it. So it's a fascinating field to be in. And another love of mine is design. And I love working with designers. I love working with user research and combining all of that to bring a product which is valuable. Yeah, it's amazing. And that's the talk about, so how do we combine for a very tech product, an internal developer platform. You wouldn't directly think product thinking, but it applies and it applies really beautifully. So I'm excited.
I think that's actually very important. I think people building internal developer platforms, when it's not your direct customer face, often forget about the customer component of it and forget that any platform that's even targeted at developers is targeted for humans to use. It's got to be easy, it's got to be accessible. And so, yeah, I like the idea of having your product focus, but from a people-centric perspective, even if it's for something internal. Is that something that you see as a blocker, that our companies are building internal tools or internal things and they're not considering the product part of it enough?
I don't see it enough. That I don't know if it's a blocker, but if I look at teams who are building tooling for engineers, for instance, they don't necessarily share the product mindset. I don't know why it is, but I think that's changing, because last year I came across this white paper written by Abby Noda and Nicole about DevX and the three core dimensions of DevX, where they actually put the engineer in the equation. I think software productivity has been focused on tools a long time, from Agile to DevOps. And now you see, okay, we can optimize software all we want, but also the happiness of the developer, the happiness of the engineer plays a huge role in how they face work and how they think about work. And I think the moment you bring the human in the equation, that's where product thinking, I think, automatically enters. I remember the first days of UX. UX used to be similar, user experience. So I compare it a bit to that. And I think now the paradigm is shifting to also thinking about the user for internal facing products. And I'm very happy about it. But it feels like the early days of UX to me, the DevX movement.
Okay. And then when engineers are building applications and whether or services, and whether they are internal or they are external, you know, a lot of organizations think we're building for the customer. We're going to, you know, work back from the customer from what they need. But I know in practicality, that doesn't really often happen. Mm-hmm. So what sort of advice would you give engineers and builders or even other product owners to properly understand their customers and what they actually need to build rather than just playing with the cool toys?
I think it's very easy to play with toys because the toys are really cool, I think. So I think get out of the building. Talk to the people. I think I wouldn't start building anything without knowing whom you're building for and what do they want. So that's what we did last year at NN. So when I came in and got the assignments, there was nothing in terms of research on what is the current engineering experience. So we just gathered a bunch of engineers. They were in the same building. You didn't even have to get out of it. But we talked to them. And engineers really love to share about the cool toys, but also the friction, the pain points. And actually, we didn't write code for a very long time. We talked to engineers. We talked to, we found out, okay, does this resonate? Did some surveys. And coding came much later. But I think that's the product thinking toolbox. So it's broader. You can do a discovery phase and say that it's discovery and say that you're exploring and come to a challenge on what you want to solve. And we explored, I think, 6-ish months. The only code we wrote was to see if backstage could be an option. So we did some spikes and see, okay, is this kind of technology that could help us with the portal? But I think that's the code we wrote. And we have engineers in the team, and engineers can do this too. So they can go out and talk to other engineers. Yeah, it's a different way of thinking. And I think we bring that. So our team, if to give you a little bit of idea, is placed in the infrastructure department of the company. Which is not used to going outside and asking. So that makes it interesting. So, and the boss, he even welcomed us saying that we were different. And I think he knows very well why we are different and how we are different. And this is what we bring. So all we brought was user research. This is what people think. This is what they say about your services. You don't need to like it, but this is what they say about it. What do you think about it? Can we improve something there? And I think that mindset is a very nice mindset to have. It's not easy to do, but if you start with the user, just people, just talk.
Do people challenge the time it takes to do that? Because you want to be a product team, people are working in an agile or DevOps kind of way, and they're having 2-week, 3-week sprints, 1-week sprints. Yep. Want to be really iterative to get things out. If you had to say to someone, oh, can we pause for a month or two to do our user research? I can imagine some product owners or people thinking, oh, that's crazy. So how do you sort of cross that challenge?
That's a nice one. I think in a corporate, if you say it like that, you will be challenged because the idea is to start sprinting.
Yeah.
For me, you can start the first sprint only if you know what you want to be doing. And we actually didn't know that. So how we brought it as we want to first understand in this huge complex product for whom we want to solve, what are we going to solve? And the only way we can do it is to run a pilot to see what needs and pain points there were. We, of course, have a very big strategy we want to also build on. So talking, so we sold it as we are doing discovery and exploring the product. The model I used for this is the double diamond from the Design Council. And it at least, I think, talks about the phases before building software. And I think having a model like that and talking about it helps because it's also something people don't recognize that sprints can come later, but you have to understand what you have to build.
So what are some of those phases that people should be thinking about before they doing their discovery?
So the double diamond is something I use a lot for communication, and the left diamond talks about doing the right thing. And it has a diverging and a converging phase. So it talks about discovery, which is divergent. Basically, everything goes. Every day is different. Your product is growing and growing and growing. And then you say, hey, that's something we want to solve. So then you start converging to a point and building to a vision. And those phases can take anywhere between a couple of weeks up to a couple of months. And I think there are very good artifacts you can use to communicate how that phase is going. Because that's what management also is looking for. Okay, you can't keep saying for 6 months that you have been exploring. What we did is to show, have reports, have results published. This is what we interviewed. This is what came out of it. This is a service blueprint. This is how it looks like. You know, and it's huge. We need to slice it. And so actually talking about artifacts in the design phase and coaching a bit on that helps talk about it. And we actually start sprinting last month. So last month was our first sprint. And then we said, hey, okay, now we are going to sprint because now we know what we want to build. And I think Scrum is awesome in knowing and in sprinting to a software delivery.
But I suppose even in the discovery phase, if organizations are used to having a two-week cadence and maybe they've got reporting mechanisms and things around that, you could still sort of not sprint in the way of software coding, but your design decisions and whether you are meeting with five of your potential customers or 10 of your customers in the first week and building documentation, I think you could probably follow that methodology of the time-based thing, but you're doing your design phase, not sprinting onto the keyboard straight away.
Correct. That's You do have a cadence in exploration and design. Only it's difficult to, because working software is always great to show, great to demo. So you have to come up with artifacts to communicate. And they are there. And you have to really find them. But user research is something which tends to take time. If you want to do a DevEx survey, you are 2 months down. You can say, okay, results will be in 2 months, but you can do other stuff. So the beauty of the double diamond is that you don't need to wait for something to finish. You can start a lot of things at the same time. You can actually diverge, and it depends on how good your team is in exploration. You can send everybody out on different paths and have them come together and communicate. We didn't communicate cadences. I think what we did is we said we are exploring and knowing what to build the product. And every month we had this reporting to management. And somehow I think management, so this is also having big top-down support at our company. So they know this is good for the company. And we have been building products at this company for a long time now. So they also know who we are and what we are capable of. I think that also helps that they trust us with building the product.
So what sort of kind of personality skills or tools and tricks, even that's not software development tools, but sort of personal skills that can developers or architects or people learn or understand to make this more successful? Because I think the bigger picture as well is that you can spend a few months doing your design, but then ultimately you know you're going to build the right thing. You can start really quickly and then iterate really quickly. Yeah. But if you land up on the cycle of building the wrong thing, it's going to potentially take a longer time. So what are the sort of personal skills that people can learn to make them better at this?
I think what it starts with is don't be afraid of failure. I think this is the
truth. So that's very similar in the sort of agile way of being able to iterate quickly.
So that's why it fits really well with agile. I think design is a discipline who validates and invalidates hypothesis every time. And if you know that, and Scrum has that too, inspect and adapt. So they have a similar language. But you need people who can deal with uncertainty and unknown. So if you have people in the team who are not afraid of failing, or not afraid of not knowing something, you have a great team in place. And typically you try out something, you make a prototype, whether it's a paper prototype, and say, hey, would you like to have this? And if the answer is no, then you don't need to build it, right? So that kind of personality you're looking for. So people who not only write code, but can also draw a simple prototype and show it and say, hey, is this okay? Is not okay? So the whole trial and error and finding out what actually works and resonates and basically having a feedback loop with your user. I think Amazon calls it customer obsession. It is an obsession and it's obsession with the customer. And the moment you forget the customer, it doesn't work. The customer always needs to be in the loop. Yeah. And as a large corporate like NN, it's very easy to forget about the customer. So it feels sometimes like you're building products for the stakeholders because they are always there telling you what needs to be built, what's priority.
And they may have the money which is going to pay for it.
They have the money and it's great. And I think Marty Kagan makes such a good point here. You have to build products that customers love and work for the business. So it needs to work for both. Only one voice is a bit higher. at big companies. And I think my job is to have the other voice very high and to have a team which appreciates that.
And I think it's very powerful understanding, building things for the right customers. But I know Simon Wardley's a speaker at this conference as well, and the whole Wardley mapping thing, where you literally start at the very end, and you know, what is the ultimate user need? And the ultimate user need is never to, you know, use a website or to access this. It's I want information, I want to book a ticket, or I want to use Canonica thing of making a cup of tea or that kind of thing. Yeah. And that's the actual use case, and try and work everything back from that. So, I mean, where should people start in terms of how do they define what the customer problem is, or is that also part of the research?
So I'm going to say a controversial thing now, because some people like this framework and some don't, but jobs to be done.
Yep.
Framework is something I use a lot, and knowing what's the job to be done is very hard, because it's not always intuitive what you think it is. So for an IDP, the job to be done is not saving time. That's not the job, but actually getting to and defining jobs to be done and actually uncovering that would be the starting point for me. And once you have them clear, once you have a product challenge formulated, you can learn how to slice it and make it small to fit in sprints and all of that. But jobs to be done framework is a very good mental model, and I think designers and user researchers know it. In my team, engineers know it too, because we are a product team and everybody works together. So they also have learned to appreciate design frameworks like this.
So you're building a developer portal using Backstage, a very, very common platform. What would the job to be done for implementing Backstage be, just so people can have an example of, you know, understanding from the tech side to the people side of what the actual job to be done would be?
Yeah, that's a nice question. So we came up with two jobs to be done. So we have engineers in product teams who are building customer-facing products. We are an insurance company, we are a bank. So what they join the company to build an app, or they join the company to make some kick-ass website to do an insurance flow. They're not looking at doing heavy lifting or the cognitive load that comes with all infrastructure. And so that was a simple job to be done. They wanted to use the latest technologies to build customer-facing products which bring value. That's what the engineers were looking for. The second job to be done was, we didn't know where to find people. So it's like, okay, which software do we have and who is behind it? So basic search, that was another job to be done. I know there are a lot of engineers at this company, but I don't know who they are, whether they are good, why they chose a certain technology. So community and knowledge sharing. That's another one which comes across a lot with interviews, because we have a C-load organization, we have a bank, we have an insurer, we have pensions, and people, of course, don't speak to each other. They don't even meet each other. But there is a lot of goodness built at one place which can be used by another. And actually, engineers are very curious about that. So they kept saying, I don't know if there is an API already for this at the company, where can I find it? So those two, the exploration part, I think that comes naturally with engineering. They will Google but at the company, so having a Google-like service at the company, that was one of the jobs they were looking to get done to save time as well. And the second one was to, don't worry me about all this other stuff, let me build software which is for our customers. So those two we could boil down.
Excellent. Now, thank you for that, because I think sometimes the jobs to be done from an external customer can be quite clear, but the internal customer, because it's internal and there isn't, you know, necessarily revenue generating or this kind of thing, can be complicated to understand. So I appreciate that. I think one of the issues I see sometimes with internal teams is they build platforms and they don't quite realize that they're actually products. And so they don't treat them like products. And so products need, you know, marketing and sales and engineering and all the kind of functions as a product. But, you know, people will build a platform and just expect developers to come and use it, or they will force developers to come and use it. So how does one evolve the product thinking to for it to be successful within an organization?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are gonna look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come. I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
That's a great question. I think we are an example of an organization which doesn't do it well. And when you talk to engineers, they tell you that. Like, most of the engineers, they feel that the central IT is only pushing them services which they don't know, and not caring about the use cases they want to use it for, and not advising them properly. And the most often, they go around it. So that's the phenomenon when you see that a lot of people are not actually using your platform, but going around it and building stuff. Because, like you said, software is so great these days. There are so many options to do something like that. So this is a very general phenomenon happening everywhere. So the moment you see that people are going around it, I think you as a product team need to ask again, hey, how are you solving this problem? Because apparently I'm offering you a service which can solve this, but you're not using my service, so you're using something else. I think this is the brilliance of jobs to be done. People will get their job done with or without you. And if the platform teams are curious to their users and ask them, how are they actually fixing that problem? Instead of asking, why aren't you using my product? So how are they fixing their problem? They will tell you what they are using and how you could have made your products resonate with them.
Maybe that's a question when people even go to the jobs to be done framework, is to ask the question, well, how would they do the job without the tool that I'm building?
Exactly.
To see if they can, you know.
Exactly. That would be where I would start. Because this company, it's a huge company, and people have built up all kinds of castles around the platform to solve their problem. I think each of our department has a lot of their own platform-like services on the platform. And that's, I think, a very natural way of working if you don't have product thinking.
I think someone I've worked with closely, Gregor Hoppe, he's done his enterprise integration patterns, done a lot of work, and he's written a book recently about platforms and products. And one of the things he spoke about, which I liked, is if people aren't using your product in ways you didn't expect, then you didn't actually design your product correctly. That your platform needs to be flexible enough that people can build on top of it and do crazy things that you never expected. So how does one design for that when a platform can be, you know, very broad? It doesn't, you know, the more niche and more locked down it is, the less people are going to be able to do it. So how do you have sort of the expansive thinking to make a platform that's useful for broader things?
I think Gregor Hope is wonderful in how he thinks about platforms. I think my team is a big fan of Gregor. I think you need to have a combination of both. So you should have an open thing where people can build on and do their thing and experiment and try out things, but also build some journeys and specific experiences for specific people, because not everybody is looking to explore around your platform.
Because there are particular jobs to be done.
So we have, for instance, in the last 5-ish years, have quite an agreement on how we want to build our web applications. So the JavaScript, React, serverless stack. I mean, when we have that agreement, why would you want every engineer to go through what's possible on AWS? We already knew that. And if you can deliver that as an experience and as a specific journey and keep the platform open, then you have a combination in possible, because you'll never serve all the users, but at least try to serve some. That's I think, the key point here. With the IDP, I'm also not looking upfront to serve all of NN engineers. That's a huge group, and not everybody is. We have low code. We have all the platforms you can think on this planet. I think we have it in house. But my intention is to deliver specific experiences for specific jobs to be done, and how specific you make it, how better the user experience will be, and that's why people will use your product. And I think platform design should be able to accommodate for this. So it should be composable, modular, and all those great things. But a product can be very narrow and very tailor-made for a persona or a customer segment.
I like that distinction between having an open platform which you then build particular products on to solve different jobs to be done. I also think that companies often create, I think they need to create the one platform that their whole organization is going to run on. And my thinking is when we, work in an agile way and, even microservices and everything needs to fast iteration, as you said before, that probably your organization needs multiple platforms that maybe multiple different teams will look after for jobs to be done. So what's your thinking on, having one big platform that to rule them all versus, multiple platforms?
I think after looking at my company, I don't have the notion that we can have one platform. I think we should have fewer than we have today. That could be good.
In IT, there's always too much.
So. There's always too much, and we have too much. And I think that's a strategy we are going for, that we want to standardize on what we want to do. So I think we'll have less flavors on things we have and some good decisions being made. But yes, these platforms will be there. And they can remain next to each other. And basically for me, it starts with whom are you serving and what are the use cases they are looking for. And if you have that in mind, it's okay if you have private cloud, public cloud, or low code and more stuff behind it. But that mindset of who are the teams using your platform and how are they using it, knowing that and bringing that, I think is important to consider. Next to all the finances, and that's considered anyway. So why, how much does it cost to host this? So that part is in the equation. The other one, not so much. So I think that makes a complete picture for me.
Interesting. With your background being in art and design, I think that's a fascinating mix because you have these ideas of software developers being, very, very technical, very unarty, very, unless you're doing front-end design, very undesigny. And I'm probably the world's worst artist. I can basically draw stick figures. But I think in software development, there's a very creative part to it and a very much, design thinking and creative and artistic kind of things that may be expressed in code rather than in pictures or poetry or that kind of thing. So How does one encourage the software industry to bring in more of this sort of artistic element to delight people?
I think it's a great segue. So I have been an artist all my life, and I've also studied computer engineering. So there was nothing in the study which felt that it was not creative. I think computers is an extremely creative profession. And I see that in a lot of people. It's how can I solve this problem in a creative way? I think in large companies, you have the engineers are just seen as people who code and not people who actually solve a business problem. So if you can also bring the IT teams closer to the business, and that's where I have been very privileged in my career to being in those small innovation-like projects where you just had three people and the business problem was very well known. Oh, we want a different way of doing car insurance. And then it's like, oh, we can maybe use serverless this and that. So that's where the creativity comes for, where you can design the solution for somebody's needs. That's where it becomes creative. So I would encourage engineers to understand the business problem and actually say, come up with 3-4 ways of solving that problem. And I think then you have a very creative team who is not, I think Marty Kagan calls it the feature team. So you don't want to have a feature team. You want to have an empowered team. And an empowered team comes with which can make its own solutions. And that's, I think that's where creativity is at its max in software. And the second suggestion would be to have a designer in the team. I think the designers are creative people. And it's the kind of energy that it brings to the team. I mean, they're always organizing team activities. And they are those team activities are extremely creative. And the software engineers feel, maybe that's too much for me. But when they go there, they really have fun. So having different people in the team, the diversity of design and software engineering together, I think is hugely creative. I don't think I can be in a team anymore without a designer and without engineers together. So I really like that combination, and that's a boost of creativity always.
And I suppose that becomes not just a tech design, but an organizational design of co-locating people with different skill sets together in maybe not necessarily an immediate team, but even within a, you know, a smaller organization or something, to be able to help each other out to have different skill sets to solve a problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think at NN, we made a start with a template, a team template, which looks like this, having UX design and engineering in the same team with products. So that triad, yeah, and actually having a dedicated designer and engineers, yeah, that makes a huge difference to team dynamics and the conversations that happen. There's a lot of art. We have gone to so many museums in the last months. It's awesome. And the other way around as well. So designers, our designer was actually excited to do some JavaScript and he wanted to build a website. So it works also the other way around, because it's contagious the other way around as well. And I think it's creativity that binds these two very big disciplines together. And I think the purpose of solving something, a business problem or a user problem, yeah, that's huge.
And I suppose it ties back to the very beginning and even your talk, that the closer your engineers get to the customers or what they're building for it, they're going to have more empathy for what they need.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be more creative rather than just being a sort of feature factory of writing, you know, functions in code.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And with the whole explosion of, you know, AI and generative AI, I mean, what are your thoughts? I know it's a broad question on, you know, the creative part of that and problem solving for engineers. And, you know, what do you sort of think in the future when you think of all the crazy Gen AI stuff that's been on us recently?
I think it's fantastic. I see it as a co-pilot. Anything which adds. So it's like you have another person in the team and that's AI. And you can use it in so many ways. I don't think there goes a day where we haven't used some of the Gen AI features, whether it's writing code. I think engineers use it a lot in the team, the designers as well. And also together, yeah, I think it's such a boost to what we can do. And of course, there are downsides and we have to be careful and the bias and all of that. But in terms of additive, how much it adds to our skills, yeah, I think it's fantastic having a reviewer next to me to read my code.
Certainly explain my code the way I write it. Something needs to help.
And our user researcher used it for generating summaries, because they do like these long interviews with engineers and they have to relate back and look back and push forward. I mean, I think you guys have an idea of how much effort it takes to make a decent summary. So at least having a summary made for you is a great start, and then you edit it. So even the user research time goes down a bit. So yeah, absolutely fantastic.
Excellent. Well, Flavia, thanks so much for your time. I think this is one of the ways that GoTo as a conference is so good, because it's not just all about the technology and, you know, writing code and all this kind of thing, but they're very much a people aspect. And your thoughts and ideas on the creativity part of it, I think, is inspiring. And I think will, you know, move our industry forward, that we can even create cooler things for people. So thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Julian. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.